Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
When Diplomacy Fails presents.
Hello and welcome to When Diplomacy Fails.
Hey guys, welcome to When Diplomacy Fails. Welcome to When Diplomacy Fails.
Hello and welcome to
Hello
When Diplomacy
Hello and welcome
fails.
To When Diplomacy Fails. A project 5 years in the making.
The Franco-Prussian War.
The 7 years war.
Of the When Diplomacy Fails special on Napoleon.
The Crimean War.
To When Diplomacy Fails special on World War I.
The Dutch Revolt.
To the When Diplomacy Fails special on the 30 Years' War.
The July Crisis Anniversary Project.
The Swedish Deluges.
Britain goes to war.
The 1916.
To the Franco-Dutch War of 1672.
This is When Diplomacy Fails Remastered. Hello, history friends, and you are very welcome to, well, another collaboration episode with someone that it's very unlikely you will know. But that's my job. Today I'm here to introduce you to Vincent W. Rospond, who you should know because, well, to put it quite simply, he's my publisher. He's the reason why I have a book, and, well, he does a pretty good job. He's a friend of the podcast. In fact, he's a patron of the podcast. And he's done a lot for me. And he's doing a lot for you as well, because he's bringing history out there. And we talk a lot about lots of different things. It's a great conversation. In fact, it's so good. I felt like if it was an hour, like a big hour-long block, you guys wouldn't really appreciate it as much. So I just decided to split it in half, just two fairly even halves that I feel will help you digest the conversation and the information better. We talk about everything. He's got a massive interest in Polish history, so we're able to talk about that. And yes, that means he probably will be making an appearance for the Polish history mini-series, so you can look forward to that. But yeah, he's a great guy. Talking about publishing, how to get into publishing, how he got into publishing, how Wing Tsar Publishing, which is the name of his publishing company, how that's kind of his baby as much as When Diplomacy Fails is mine, and how hobbies are important, how following your ambition and your dream is important, and how having such ambitions and not being afraid to just go after them. I know it sounds kind of romantic, but it can be something as simple as setting up a podcast. And as he says, if he can do it, well, hey, anyone can. Anyway, if you're interested in the works, in the items, in the books that Vincent Rospond has helped to bring out, that he's helped to publish, then visit wingedhussarpublishing.com. That again, wingedhussarpublishing.com. I don't want to spoil too much of it for you guys. I feel like it's a really good conversation. It's real good free-flowing, good content within it and everything else. So, yeah, I just think you should enjoy the show. Let me know what you thought. Let him know what you thought. Track us both down and tell people about it. And a huge thanks once again to Vincent for, well, taking time out of his busy schedule to come and talk to a fellow history friend and all you guys about what it is that he does and, well, why we should all care. Enjoy, guys. It's a good one. And I'll talk to you after.
So, a bit of a special podcast here, History Friends. Today we have a Mr. Vincent Rospond on the podcast. Say hello, Vince. How's it going?
Hello, Vince. How are you?
Very good. Very good. So, I believe you are a esteemed guest of some form because you had the honor, and pun intended, to recently, well, somewhat recently, publish When Diplomacy Fails' first book.
Yes, A Matter of Honor, which was great. For those who don't know, it's based on the thesis you were talking about. I think you did a brilliant job putting it together. It's a very interesting and concise explanation of how Britain went to war in World War I. Illustrated, I might add, with several pictures and maps. Oh, no, yes. We didn't put maps. Yes, available for a shameless plug. It's available on Amazon, all good bookstores, and as an ebook as well, I might add.
Yes.
For Kindle and EPUB.
Very good. Very, very good. So all your first book needs, and I do believe it's a 3-book deal, as far as I'm aware now. I have been told this on the grapevine, but I do believe that there's a few other ones coming.
I believe so. I think we're going to do with 30 Years War. Is that the next one?
Mm-hmm. That's correct. Yes. Very much looking forward to that because the last time I wrote anything about the 30 Years War, actually, that was a very long time ago. That was 2013. Yeah. I finished that just before the July crisis. So,
yeah, I'll be cracking the whip sometime in the next month or two so you can get that done.
Yeah. Cool. The idea is now this is released amidst the 5-year birthday of When Diplomacy Fails. So I've been keeping it a secret all this time, but it's not really a secret anymore. Basically, there's two episodes released every day for 5 weeks. It's insane. It's a rather large workload, and it's been interesting. It's been fun to try and multitask and get it all done, but we're near the end of it now, and I can just kind of let it all release itself. So the idea being that while you're listening to this, History Friends, I am most likely working on that latest book. So, very exciting times.
Excellent.
So, Mr. Rospond, which you told me not to call you, but I'm going to call you anyway.
That's okay. It's good.
Tell me a bit about yourself. Tell me a bit about what it is that you do, and most of all, why we should care.
Ah, why you should care. That's a broader, more in-depth question. But I am the publisher of Winged Hussar Publishing, which does two different things. One is we publish history, mostly military, but not exclusively military history. And I specialize in Eastern European history. So Poland, Russia, Ukraine are my areas of expertise. We do a bunch of different things. We just published a book on Anna of Saxony. So it runs the gamut. But so I edit the books published by other people. And occasionally I dig in and write a book myself. I just finished one on the Polish Army of 1939 and the campaign, you know, opening days of the war campaign. But we also do science fiction and fantasy. Sometimes some people have different difficulty telling the difference between the two, history and fantasy, but it's true. It's true. Yeah, so we publish print books, we publish ebooks, and we've just done a little foray for some of our fiction into audiobooks. You know, and we cover the globe in English, so pretty much anywhere you are, you can order our books and get them in your bookstore, or just look at our website, and we'll send them out to you.
Sweet, sounds pretty good. And remind me again, what is the name of that website?
Winged Hussar, Hussar Publishing.com.
Very straightforward. As someone who regularly plugs their own website, I always enjoy helping other people plug theirs, giving everyone else a helping hand.
But and yeah, I appreciate it. Yes.
Of course. Yeah, of course. Well, you did me a great service by getting in contact with me all those years ago and insisting that we expose my works to the world in published form. So here we are now. It's almost come full circle. And I'm really excited to have you on so that more people can find out about the work you do. And I'm sure people would be interested as well, because I'm aware that many people who listen to podcasts and listen to or would read any kind of audiobooks or books like that would want to know kind of how the process works. So I suppose that's a question I have to ask you, not necessarily how the process works, but, well, how about we start at the beginning? How does someone get into publishing, full stop?
You have to have a high tolerance of pain and a lot of patience. No, I mean, I got into publishing some a little bit accidentally, but somewhat because I always take the long game in just about everything I do. I was working in finance. The company I was working with acquired a magazine around the time the European, in 1992, European Union was coming together, and it was a business journal about that. So I got involved in publishing that. Didn't last too long, but I went from there to working for Simon & Schuster in New York. Got to on the business end of it, finance end of it, and eventually got into the sales and marketing end. And all along the way, I'm the kind of person that asks a lot of questions. So I tried to find out not just my job, but everyone else's job too, because I'm interested.
Yeah.
But also helped me do my job better because I understood what everything put together. And then eventually I ended up working for a long time for Games Workshop's publishing arm called the Black Library. I was in charge of global sales and marketing there and then the U.S. sales. So I've been involved in a lot of different aspects of publishing from the, you know, getting it out to market thing. But then in the process of that, I did have my degree in history. I have a master's degree in history and some credits towards a doctorate that I gave up very, not quickly, but for a variety of reasons, because I had to work. We all know how that is, though.
Oh, yeah. I empathize, sympathize, and everything else. I'm still weighing up my future myself, so I know what you've gone through, at least part of it anyway.
I ended up just because I became friendly with some of the people at Osprey Books, I proposed a book to them that I did on the armies of the Polish partitions, and they very graciously accepted. I worked through that. Based on everything I know about publishing, I said, well, I guess I'm just too dumb to not realize how difficult things are, but the challenge didn't bother me. So I used all those skills. I started Winged Hussar. The first book we did was actually Caesar's Gaelic Wars. And then from there, we've published now, I think, 10, 12 history books and about 20 fiction, science fiction.
Impressive.
And we've been in business now for 3 years.
Very good. Very good. And I'm gonna pick you up on what you said there. How you said you learned from your fellow colleagues how everything sort of worked. Because correct me if I'm wrong, but you're essentially doing the job of numerous people, aren't you? In Winged Hussar.
Yes. You know, it's essentially a two-man operation.
Mm.
Myself, my overarching responsibility. My son also works with me. He does editing for science fiction and fantasy. I do a lot of the work as far as layout, cover design, editing, at least on the history side. But I work with a couple of really good guys as well as freelancers and who do things, maps and some covers for me and some layout. I'm very fortunate and I know a lot of very talented people. So I try to draw on their abilities when I can to help make things better.
But I'm going to remind you what you, because we have a somewhat unusual email schedule in that, well, I've always been impressed by how quickly you always respond to my emails, considering my rambling nature within them and the time of day which I tend to send them. But on one occasion, you told me that you never sleep. To what extent would that be correct?
Well, there's a lot of truth to that. As I said, for a number of years, I worked for an English company out of the States. Because of that, in order to get a hold of people sometimes, I had to get up early. Because if I got up at a normal day, everyone's out to lunch by the time I'm up online. So I would get up early and I'd get home. And so I just tend to do that. And then I also used to deal with Australia as well, so I'd be up later. So in my work schedule, I don't know if you've ever seen Men in Black, but it's that old 24-hour Centurion calendar clock, whatever. I sort of adhere to that, and I'm sort of wired in. So wherever I am, as I get these emails, I try to respond to them, because otherwise I'll promptly forget about it, and then someone will be mad at me. But I do tend to be up a lot. I love interacting with people, and if you ask me a question, I'll try and get you an answer as quickly as I can.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I've always been very impressed about your punctuality with emails. It makes a big difference when you're on the other side of the world and you have to rely on this person to bring what you have like to life, basically. So what I wanted to ask as well, you've been in publishing you've had Winged Hussar for a few years, but before then you've been in it a while anyway. What do you love about it? What do you dislike about it? Let's start with the positive first. What do you really enjoy about it?
thing I really enjoy about it is pretty much everything. I love books. I've always loved books. I love looking how they're constructed. I love reading them. You know, since I've actually been running Winged Hussar, I actually enjoy putting books together.
Sure.
It's just a fascinating process. I like the creative process. I like creating things. I kind of feel that definitely on the history side, but even in the fantasy science fiction side, I feel like when we're creating books like this, we're giving something back and creating knowledge, transferring knowledge to other people. Mm. I think that's a good aspiration. One of the things about Winged Hussar I said is I focus on Eastern European, mostly because I found, you know, my family is half Polish and Ukrainian. Growing up, I couldn't find diddly about that history in English. You usually, in school, you'd get a paragraph that said Poland was partitioned 3 times, and then it disappears. And that's about it. There's not a whole lot of information available in English, at least. In the old days, Germany and Russia had a vested interest to try and keep information and sort of poo-poo the history of some of these countries in Eastern Europe. And there's a very rich and long history there, and I try to make it available to people. As I said, it's not exclusively what I do, but it's one of my guiding lights, as it were, to publishing.
Sure. Well, that's good, because it follows in a lot with how I view podcasting as well, because maybe I should just ask, first of all, your interests are kind of solidly Eastern European. Would that be right to say?
I guess, yeah. I'm really all over the place, like a magpie.
Yeah.
To be honest. And if you look at my catalog, I mean, obviously I've done work in ancient history, work in modern. It's just all over, pretty much. But yeah, Eastern Europe is sort of where my sweet spot is.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's good. A lot of the stuff that you'd be covering to do with Poland and the Polish partitions, they really are. I mean, there's a genuine need for Polish history stuff, especially because people just aren't aware of the influence Poland has had, like in terms of having its written constitution. And I think that the image of in the early 1600s, well, even at the in the midst of the 30 Years' War, really, just some really interesting stuff that went on between the Polish king and the Swedes and then, like, the family.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
The affair going on there, like that's movie quality material there, really.
It's like Dynasty, only played out with, or like, because they were all related. Part of the whole thing about the Swedish invasion in the aftermath of the 30 Years' War was that the Vasa kings in Poland did not want to give up their titles in Sweden, even though they hadn't ruled there in like 50 years.
I know, yeah.
There was an actual attempt to broker an alliance between the two of them, but for reasons of religion and just being ornery, neither one of them could just pull the trigger on that agreement.
Yeah, I believe Charles Gustav of Sweden, he wanted to ally with the Poles against the Russians, but Polish king wouldn't give up his claim on the Swedish throne, which was just such a baseless claim to have. And because of that, then, he kind of said, well, we can hardly ally with someone who claims my throne. However, unreasonably he does. So he had to invade
Poland. Yeah.
He didn't have to invade Poland, but he had to jump in there and get some spoils while he could. And because of that, then, yeah, the Swedish deluge just happened. That was episode 27, I think it was. Yeah, I really enjoyed doing that. A really interesting period in history. But I just found a generation before that in the 1650s, you had Polish kings marching into Russia. And I think it was Sigismund III tried to get his son installed as Tsar and burned down Moscow.
Yeah, they had actually captured Moscow.
Mm.
Vladislav IV had carried the title of Tsar of Russia in his titles after he became king. Mm-hmm. But that's where they put the false Dmitry on the throne there. And eventually the Russians recaptured the city. And then after they killed him, this false Dmitry, they stuffed him in a cannon and shot him towards Poland. So
I don't remember that bit. That's brilliant. It says a lot about Russia-Polish relations, really.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. They never seemed to get much better from there, though, for some reason.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of a downward spiral. Although in the Great Northern War in 1700-21, which was Peter the Great of Russia's kind of defining moment, I suppose you could say, that was an alliance between the Poles and the Russians, and it was kind of the other way around from the Swedish deluge, in that it was out of necessity, they believed, to team up against Sweden, because Sweden had such a young king, and they felt they could take advantage of his youth and inexperience, sort of thing.
And really, the downward spiral of Poland's politics comes out of that period, because Peter then uses that as an excuse to sort of make it a client state, you know, between the Saxon kings and the Polish nobility sort of fighting amongst themselves. But that is that's the nature of history. It's ever going. It's not, you know, it's not defined by one period. There's a long process there.
Mm-hmm. Have you said that there wasn't very many books. I mean, the books that come to mind, I think Adam Zamoyski, is that the name
yes.
of the author? Yeah. He had a book on, I believe it was during the Napoleonic era, though. Was that right, or was it?
Yeah, he's done a couple of books during that. I think he's done a general history, too, of Poland in the 19th and 20th century. And then Norman Davies' God's Playground.
Yeah,
it's a good generalist history. Before that, I think the only things you had to go by were the Cambridge History of Poland is okay, but it's a bit dated and repeats a lot of old inaccurate things in it. There's a gentleman named Oskar Halicki who wrote some books in English on Polish history. He was more of a nationalist, and he wrote partly in the pre-Polish era of World War I and then afterwards.
Okay, wow.
So his viewpoint is a little colored in some respects. I mean, but still general information. It works out okay.
Sure, yeah. It's interesting you mentioned the post kind of World War I era where Poland was like reconstituted as a state, if you like. This example of my secondary school or high school education shows how kind of like devoid of proper information it was, because I remember looking, because I was always interested in the First World War, and I think it's evidently continued, that interest has, but I remember in fifth or sixth year, so it's 17 or 18, looking at the Treaty of Versailles, and it's like, oh, Poland was created as a state kind of thing. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's interesting. And then I remember going to the shops and seeing like Polish food and like the Polish language and everything. And I was thinking, like, how on earth did this is how ridiculous it was. I was like, how did the Allies like make a language and like make a country and make all this food and all this culture in the space of like 80 years. Like, I had no concept of the fact that Poland existed very much so before then. It was such a good example of how kind of in need of brushing up, but I suppose you can only expect so much from secondary school history, really.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the one thing, and this is actually another reason why I do this, is secondary history, you're only going to get glossy pictures of a lot of information until you get to college, and then you maybe have a chance to go into a little bit more. But you need to have the information available in a way people can use it. Obviously, the best thing you can do is try and do research for information in a native language. It's not as easy to do that with some of these languages, just about any language, I think, for some people. But when you're dealing about multiple languages or multiple cultures, it makes it even more difficult. So what I'm trying to do is make some of this stuff available, not as the final word in any one thing, but it's a starting point for you to use to branch out and then look at some of the sources I put in there and look for new things as well.
That's a fairly good approach. So looking forward, say, is there any kind of, because you mentioned you'd done some works on the Polish army and you recently completed a book, actually, somehow you managed to have time for that. Is there anything looking forward? Do you think there's anything left you can flesh out in Polish history?
Oh, no, there's tons of things I can flesh out. At the moment, for instance, I've done the books on the Polish partitions for Osprey. I'm going to expand that in a book that I'm going to come out with probably maybe in a year or so on the partition era. I've already done a book on the Polish armies and the Napoleonic Wars. In the planning stages, I've got one on, obviously enough, winged hussars, sort of the golden era, which I'm calling Eastern Empire because it's basically Poland from the early 1500s through to the end of the 18th century. Mm. And it's a large country at that point.
Oh, big and time. One state's multi-ethnic, the largest. Yeah.
A large multi-ethnic country. As we recognize now, Ukrainian, Belarus, even Moldavian and German peoples within that area. So that's something that I've got planned. I'm also doing one on the November insurrection of 1831, which is a military campaign. The Poles actually held their own. Unfortunately, the Russians, although Austria was supposedly neutral during that insurrection, they allowed Russian troops to enter their territory and go around in order to attack the revolutionary. So, you know, aside from that, let's face it, all's fair in love and war, I guess. But it's interesting areas to look at why and how and what for the reactions. Those are some of the areas that I'm looking at. I'm working now with some Polish authors that I'm translating works into English on a variety of those areas as well.
Yeah, great. That's good. It's good to know. I think because to break the fourth wall, you and I actually did this already, but then we had recording issues and or like post-production issues, let's just say. So we just thought it would be easier to redo it again. But I remember the first time around believing really emphatically the importance in doing historical products. That's a really bad turn of phrase, but basically making things for the reading or listening public or what have you that delves into areas of importance in history, but areas that are very underrepresented. And I think that's kind of the theme. It's not necessarily the theme of my podcast, because while I've looked at stuff like the Swedish deluges or, say, like the War of the Polish Succession, like random stuff, I've also looked at the First World War and the July Crisis. So it's not, I mean, you couldn't say it's mainstream history, but you also couldn't say that it's totally niche. But in a way it is. But I think I would certainly characterize, and now I mean this in the best, most positive sense, I would characterize your works as like niche works, but like niche in a way that I wish people would make it not niche. By that I mean.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, I view it as a niche subject in that it's not mainstream. People are not going to be, the topic du jour is not going to be, did you hear about the Polish Constitution of 1790? You know, have you read? That's never going to be, you know, at a cocktail party type thing.
Depends what cocktail party you go to.
Yeah, I was going to say, depend on the crowd you go to. But obviously, it's an area of importance. I don't want to get so niche of a niche that we're talking about what type feathers winged hussars had on their wings. And there are people who will go ad infinitum about those sort of things. You want to provide a general history, give people a basis to start making decisions, start looking into other things. I think a lot of things that you end up doing, it is more of a general history, as maybe a select area within that, but I don't necessarily think of it so much as niche, but sort of spotlights on areas within the broad strokes of general history.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, in a way, it's I mean, definitely easier to launch a podcast on a specific area rather than launch a book for obvious reasons. But I always found it surprising that, I mean, I recently, we're recording this in February, but I recently announced on Twitter, which I have also joined, at WDF Podcast, all lowercase letters, but yeah, I recently announced that if I get to the $2,500 level of support as a monthly goal, I'll launch a History of Prussia podcast. And it always amazed me the things that the subjects in history that do have podcasts and the subjects that don't. Like, I think there's no history of Poland, as far as I know, even though I suppose they'd be hampered when they were doing that by the kind of things you mentioned there. But surely, I mean, like some kind of Anglo-Polish scholar of any kind, I mean, I'm sure there's interest, there's big time interest, just like when I announced the plans to do the history of Prussia. I mean, there wouldn't be necessarily many Prussians walking around, but that doesn't mean there'd be no interest in it, if you get what I mean.
So absolutely.
Do you think with, I suppose this is actually a roundabout way of asking you, would you be interested in doing any kind of podcasts yourself in the future?
I mean, I think I would. I need to free up a little bit more time because I know it'll probably be as all-consuming as everything else I do.
Oh, it is, yeah.
it's like a heroin addict, I guess. It's like, yeah. It may not be, it doesn't seem so bad at first, but yeah, no, it is. And the way I look at it, it's not just Polish history. It's history of Eastern Europe because you've got a lot of, I guess, national ethnic groups within that area. I mean, the idea of Great Poland, Lithuania as a country is not restricted to those two nationalities. There are a large group of Ukrainians in there, modern, what we would call today Ukrainians, who viewed themselves part of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth.
Sure.
That was the whole point about Kleczynski's revolt in the 1640s, was they weren't revolting because they didn't agree with the king. In fact, the one thing they tried to make constant throughout there is they were loyal subjects of the king. They didn't like the way they were treated because of their religious background and or their linguistic background. So you've got Ukraine, you've got Belarus, you've got other Slavs within there, as I said before, even Prussians within that kingdom.
Yeah, and actually the Polish relationship with Prussia is fascinating, really, really is. And in fact, Prussia as it was, I mean, wouldn't really exist as we know it today without Poland. The actual existence of Prussia, in a way, is, I mean, it was very much shaped after the Teutonic Knights essentially lost to the Poles. It became something entirely different from what it was. And yet then, strangely enough, and like, Prussia is a weird state, and the idea of Prussian national identity is weird in itself, but even though the Poles made it less of a kind of martial state than when Brandenburg was able to take it over, the Brandenburgers tried to kind of take it back to before the Polish time and tried to kind of embrace the Teutonic martial ideas, which is very interesting.
The one thing about history in that area is it's very much to the whims of chance and luck that certain things happen. I mean, the Prussian dynasty essentially dies out and are succeeded by their cousins from Brandenburg's, was it Sigmaringen? I think it is. They lead to the rise of the great Prussian state.
Mm-hmm.
Even up to the time of the Swedish deluge, Prussia was a fief of the Polish king.
Yeah.
It was only during that the leaders managed to leverage their position because of the deluge to loosen their bonds there, essentially, and create a more independent state so that they were kings in Prussia as opposed to Prussian kings.
And then I pointed this out in another conversation, but the great elector, Frederick William, in that case, I think it was in 1657 or 58, he only actually got away with doing that. Yeah, the first king in Prussia in 1701, he only got away with doing that because the War of the Spanish Succession was about to erupt. Carlos II was about to die, and the Holy Roman Emperor wanted Brandenburg, Prussia, on its side. So ordinarily declaring yourself a king in Prussia wouldn't necessarily work, but in this case it did, because the Holy Roman Emperor Leopold was so desperate for Brandenburg's aid that he said, sure, just do whatever you want as long as you keep supporting me, kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what I mean. It's the opportunist time that the electors took advantage of. That's just wily political craft, I guess.
Big time, yeah.
All righty. What did you think? He's a good guy, isn't he? Yes, don't worry. That's the first part. It's kind of like talking all through history, all through Polish history, kind of the Polish partitions, kind of this was at the stage I was kind of getting the feel for his historical interest, and the wheels were ticking in my mind, thinking, oh, he'd be good to have on for the Polish miniseries, because he's the kind of guy I could ply for information about, like, Polish uniforms and weapons and all the kind of, well, I suppose the stuff I would find boring, but the stuff people don't find boring. But yeah, he'll come in handy, let's just say. But it'll also come in handy because he's going to be publishing two more books of mine, so that's great also. Yeah, so I hope you guys will check out the second part of the interview, and I hope you enjoyed this part as well. Let me know what you think through the usual channels. That part's out right now, so go listen to it, go and enjoy it. And thanks for listening. I'll be seeing you all very soon.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.